Now call the second case on today's oral argument calendar. That case is number A23-1671, Michael M. Whalen versus 200 River Drive Condominium Association. I believe council are aware that each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will then have an opportunity for rebuttal of 5 minutes. Counsel for appellant, you may approach, and when you begin, please state your name and the name of your client.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Carl Christensen. I represent Michael Whalen, who's here today in the courtroom as well, along with my associate, Christopher Wilcox. We're here today because the 200 River Drive Condominium Association plays by its own rules. What our argument essentially is, and what I'll argue before you this morning, is that related to the matters before the court, the vote that was taken in this matter was not done correctly. The assessment was improper, and indeed the foreclosure was improper. One window into all of these improprieties is to look at the violations of the Mincoya that occurred related to Mr. Whalen that the lower court didn't address. When this all began, or when this happened, when the assessment was rumored to occur, Mr. Whalen approached the association and asked for three things. Asked for the authority for the assessment, asked for a copy of the contract for the contractor they're gonna hire, and asked, because this was a lot of money, if the association was gonna review the contract with an attorney. The answers to that are paradigmatic of what happened in this case. They said, first of all, the vote that occurred was what authorized the assessment.
If I could,
yes.
I don't want to
yes, Judge.
Totally derail your,
nope, that's problem.
Your thinking, but we only get to that question if we get through a couple of procedural challenges. One on the question of whether there was waiver by your client. The other is your argument that if we get past that, then the question of the void, whether there's the failure to postpone within the postponement pre-sale period effectively makes the foreclosure process void. I think those are the two significant procedural hurdles that we get to before we get to the question that you're raising substantively. Am I correct about that?
For the second point, the postponement is not the only basis on which the foreclosure is challenged. Also, the challenge is related to the initial service. But answering Your Honor's question, first of all, about the actual waiver issue. So the sole authority for the waiver issue is the Ballack case, an unpublished case by this court that is a lacuna in the jurisprudence of foreclosure. There's no other case that cites to it. And indeed, there's seven reasons why this court shouldn't follow Ballack. First of all, the statutory reasons. Ballack says that even though the foreclosure was improper for the, because the homeowner redeemed, that is ostensibly a waiver of claims. And we know that's not correct by looking at Minstat 580 itself. 580.18, that deals with excessive costs out of redemption. When a mortgagor bids too much at a sale, and the when a mortgagee bids too much at a sale and the homeowner redeems, if they're excessive, the homeowner has a year to challenge those costs and can get treble damages for that. The second reason we know that Ballack should not be precedential on this matter is the curative statutes, 582, 25, and 27, which indeed give 25 different reasons why a homeowner could challenge a foreclosure. Most of them have a one-year statute of limitations. They presuppose the occurrence of the foreclosure, including the issue that's before this court, failure to properly serve the homeowner under 580.03. So for that reason, if Ballack were correct, and the 580.27 and 28 basically meant that if you redeem, your claims were gone, then the curative statutes would say that. And they don't. The other five reasons I can go through them quickly. Hunter v. Anchor Bank. In that case, this court said, we're going to ignore the discordant authority that happened before, and we're going to look at Ruiz, and we're going to look at MERS again, and we're going to say, despite that authority that is binding on us, we're not going to follow it. So, and I think, and that issue was, is analogous to what's now before this court. Balak was a 2006 case. And the question in Balak is, what does void mean? And Hunter v. Anchor Bank, you answered that. You said void is void. Void is not voidable. It doesn't matter what else happened. Void is void, period. Full stop, end of discussion. In fact, you say it again in the Larson case, which is an unpublished case from here. But you said, we're not going to cherry pick the statute and say, when should the statute be strictly complied and when should it not? And then looking at the, I think the TCI case, I might be citing that incorrectly, in our reply, that one looked at the redemption of a junior creditor. And in that case, the court said, that's the TCM Properties case. In that case, the court said, look, we're not going to strictly construe the redemption to the detriment of the homeowner. In this case, or in that case, the junior redeeming party, because of the importance of redemption. So what annulment means in that statute is that the foreclosure is set aside and all the junior lien holders who would have been extinguished by the foreclosure are resuscitated. It's a legal fiction that we create to bridge a gap. And that is, it restores title, as we say in the profession, nunc pro tunc, the way it was before.
So let's assume you're, just so you don't spend all of your argument on that issue, because you have a lot you could cover. On the, what I would say is a secondary issue or the other hurdle in the case, your argument that there is the, by using the postponement process here, what happened was a lapsed foreclosure and therefore a void foreclosure. What is the case law that most directly supports that, your argument that once you have a, once you have a foreclosure in process, and you have the opportunity, the foreclosing party has an opportunity to provide notice of postponement, but doesn't provide that before the appointed date of sale, that now the foreclosure itself is just void?
Well, there's two issues impacted into that question. The first one is the initial service under 5803 that says the homeowner needs to be served 4 weeks before the sale. That never occurred. And we look to the general authority in Ruiz, Hunter, MERS, and Larson to say that that's, they didn't strictly comply with the statutes. The foreclosure is void. So the real question is the lapse question or the resuscitation question. Does 5807 give any basis for a foreclosure that wasn't properly served under 5803 to become proper after the fact? The two cases we cite to related to the interplay or the timing of 5807 are the Bennett v. Brundage case and the Pratt v. Tincon case. And in both of those, the question was, if you're supposed to give notice to the homeowner under 5807 as soon as practicable, does that mean the day before the sale? Does that mean 2 days before the sale? Or can it even be the day of the sale? And in both those cases, they said that those things were fine, but they don't, nowhere, there's not a case that considers whether a foreclosure can be postponed after the original sale date. And so those, the implication of those cases are that as soon as practicable is not after the original sale date. Going back, let's go in reverse order since we're there. Now we're at the foreclosure. The case law is clear. In fact, as we said before, I said before, the Lawson case says strict compliance is the law, period. The only time this court has looked beyond strict compliance is related to the rights of junior creditors, related to whether or not the 7-day notice required for a notice of intent to redeem as a junior creditor is strict. This court has said, no, it's not strict. That's a case neither of us cited to, but that's the Remily case, Remily v. Johnson Development Corp.
What would be the practical consequence? What would our disposition be if we agreed with your argument that because service was not proper, you can't revive the foreclosure action after the postponement, after the time of the appointed sale? What would the disposition be?
the foreclosure is void and that the association violated 515B.
Therefore and, what?
Pardon me?
Therefore what?
Well, the remedy under 515B is that the homeowners be put back in the position they were before. So the practical reality of that is that the foreclosure is undone. Whalen is returned the costs and fees and penalties and attorney's fees that he has already paid, the accelerated dues that he's already paid, and the attorney's fees that are likely pending in this case too that are to be assessed would not be assessable. They can then foreclose again if the vote were proper, or Whalen, since he's already redeemed, he's already paid the money for the underlying assessment. It would be up to them. I doubt, since Mr. Whalen has showed his desire to pay the assessment initially, it would be up to him whether he wanted to claw that back, but that wouldn't be very reasonable at this point. They would have the assessment paid and the foreclosure redone, and they wouldn't be able to collect monies they hadn't collected that they're going to, and they would have to refund what they already had collected in excess of the assessment amount. The question of whether or not then the assessment is proper or not proper, it's still before this court, but for all practical purposes, why fight that fight if he's already paid it? So we talked about the import of Balak and why this court shouldn't follow it, why the sale is not voided, working backwards from the argument I laid out, why the foreclosure is void and should be voided. It's not voidable. Now we get to the vote and the assessment themselves and whether those were done properly. The bylaws say that the members get to vote, have to vote basically to do anything except for three particular areas: maintenance, the monthly assessments, and surveillance. Those are the three areas that are reserved for a board decision. The bylaws say, the declarations say otherwise, you need a member vote to undertake an action. Now I'm gonna conflate the issue of the vote, the impropriety of the vote, and the impropriety of the assessment to point out to everyone in this room, there's no record of an assessment. There's nothing in the minutes that there was ever an assessment. And indeed the language of the vote just says approval of the balcony project. The prior vote, which the association annulled under its own authority, said approval of the project and assessment. There's evidence in the record that the association was contemplating getting a loan. There's evidence in the record that the association was contemplating using its reserve funds to pay for this. But there's no record of ever an approval of an assessment. The lower court found that they didn't need a vote, that the board didn't need a member vote.
So is that a fact dispute or a win in your an appeal?
That's an excellent question. It would be a fact dispute if the issue were merely whether or not. Well, let me say it a different way. A fact dispute does arise on whether or not this was regular maintenance or one of the areas that the board can decide on its own, or whether member vote is required. But that is unnecessary to pursue because this was a special assessment. It was $285,000, and there's nothing in the bylaws or the declarations that gives the association the power to do a special assessment without a vote. So there's no reference to a vote in the record in the minutes. The best argument is that the vote happened in secret with no minutes were taken. And clearly that's an ultra vires act that should be disregarded by this court. Looking at the vote itself, we've explained why the vote was whatever it was for. It says it's for the project. Why it wasn't proper was that they didn't convene a special meeting of the board to undertake it. There's no authority for a written ballot, but even if there were authority for that, because there is in Mincoya, they had to do it for longer than 5 days, which they didn't do. And there's other improprieties that Mr. Whalen raised during when the vote occurred that we weren't even able to answer until discovery in this case, of whether or not the allocation of the vote was apportioned appropriately. Going back to your question, Judge Ross, earlier, what is the association to do? The association could have started a new foreclosure in the pendency of the foreclosure and the postponement. Likewise, they could have taken a vote. They could have gotten the authority for an assessment. There's a lot of could-haves in this case, but the lower court found that without any authority, that the board could make all of these decisions on its own, that is related to the vote and the assessment. Only the board needed to do that. Not only is that not supported in the record, it's directly contradicted by the testimony of the board members. And indeed, it's directly contradicted by the letter sent by the association's attorney that said, we don't need authority for the project itself, but we did need to get a vote for the assessment. That was their line. I see I've run out of time. May I finish my sentence?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Judge. That was their line in this case until the final summary judgment motion, where they then introduced, we don't really need this. This was an advisory vote. The lower court found that it was absent authority of the record. In fact, made factual findings of its own, ignoring the 515B violations, and indeed ignoring the fact that there's no record of an assessment anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please state your name and your client's name, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Nevin Salimovich. I'm here on behalf of respondent 200 River Drive Condominium Association. And it seems like Your Honors have read the briefs, so I won't get into those arguments too intensely. I just want to focus my time on addressing some of the reply brief and some of the arguments appellant made today. I want to start off by talking about the serious allegations of bad faith that appellant has made and is at the end of his brief and in the reply brief. Those allegations are not necessarily supported by the record. They rely on an assertion that the respondent intentionally misled, lied, or deceived appellant.
Can I instead redirect you? I hope you can get to whatever part of the argument you'd like to, of course, but I'm curious about those intersections ahead of the substance that may resolve the case one way or the other. And maybe you can begin with your waiver argument.
Yes, Your Honor. I just want to say that, as you mentioned, the court doesn't even need to get to some of these substantive arguments because of the waiver argument. Appellant waived his right to challenge the foreclosure by redeeming under 580.27. And that waiver is there because he took an affirmative action to redeem, and 580.27 says that it annuls the sale. It makes it so the sale has not even happened. So, it's a moot question.
So why does that, I see that in the text. Why does that foreclose a challenge to the foreclosure proceeding itself? Any improprieties in that? And is there a case law to support it besides the BALAC decision, which seems to set out 580.28 and 580.27 as equal alternatives at the same moment?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, we rely on the ballot case, but also,
What is there in the text, in the language of 0.27 and 0.28, assuming that Balak, it's not precedential, whether we found it persuasive or not, it's not precedential.
Your Honor, 580.28 allows someone challenging a foreclosure to redeem it and maintain an action. And that is, in the text.
Isn't that in the text of that on a specific circumstance and a specific moment? It's when an action is brought where it's claimed that any mortgage is fraudulent or void or has been paid or discharged. And it's in a case where there's foreclosure by advertisement, where there's already been foreclosure by advertisement. None of that applies here, does it? Either of those prerequisites?
Well, Your Honor, the second prerequisite doesn't apply because appellant redeemed before the sale. If he would have waited, then that second prerequisite would apply.
Well, would apply, but in this case, given the language, doesn't apply, does it?
It does not, Your Honor.
So why would we rely upon 582.8 at all?
Your Honor, 580.28, it discusses a void mortgage, you know, the underpinnings of...
Right, but if it applies to circumstances that aren't in existence here, why is that a basis for your argument? Why would we consider it?
Your Honor, we're, respondent only puts forth the position that 580.27 annuls the sale. It does more than just put the title back and how it was. It's up to the legislature to be more clear if they want to provide some.
Well, what
more
does that mean, annuls the sale? Why does it annul challenges to the foreclosure proceeding when the issue isn't about the sale? When the challenges aren't about the sale? Given the language, why would we reach that conclusion?
Your Honor, beyond looking at that annulment language, I'm not prepared to.
Well,
to
what is the, what is, I guess that's what I'm asking. What is there in the annulment language or in case law, precedential case law that applies it that would support your position?
Well, that's laid out in Balik, as you said, it may or may not be persuasive to this court, but you know, annulment means that the sale never happened, that the foreclosure never happened, and that any challenges to that foreclosure.
Oh, but pause there. That's the jump I'm not sure I gather. Your brief does say, well, it's like the foreclosure never happened, but the statute refers to the sale. Your position is that they're one and the same.
Yes, Your Honor. The foreclosure sale is the sale that's being annulled.
Right, but the challenges to the foreclosure proceeding.
Well, Your Honor, by you know, having this issue, you know, the sale having not occurred, it's just not an issue that is alive anymore. I mean, it's a moot issue. But moving beyond that, if I may, that you know, the procedural challenges as well don't have much substance to them. Your Honor, this is a situation where appellant had notice before the sale. He had notice. He was attempted to be served, but service was not made. Eight attempts of service were made, but that's not material here because before the sale occurred, the original June 22nd sale, appellant hired an attorney and initiated a conversation with respondent about the foreclosure. And in that conversation, he knew that the sale wasn't going to happen. He knew that.
Why? Okay, so. Are you saying that service wasn't necessary because the parties were aware?
Your Honor, I'm saying that the point of some of these statutes is to effectuate, you know, give someone like appellant notice and opportunity to redeem or to challenge it or to do.
Right. I mean, that's the purpose. But in order to fulfill that purpose, there are very specific statutes that's got to be service, just like in a civil proceeding. If this were service in a civil proceeding case and the party attempts to effectuate service, but it's not effective. Would it be sufficient for that party to say that the service requirements aren't necessary because they knew about it anyway? The other party knew about it anyway. We've got proof they knew about it.
Well, Your Honor, this case here is a very specific, you know, unique circumstance. It's not as though there's question over notice or anything to that degree. The lower
there's question over service.
Yes, Your Honor. The district court didn't make any findings as to why service wasn't effectuated beyond saying that it was attempted eight times with three attempts by the sheriff.
But why does that matter if it didn't happen? I mean, there's alternatives. If you attempt personal service, there's other ways around it. You can keep trying it over and over and again. It doesn't matter whether it's eight times or 80 times if it was ineffective?
Well, Your Honor, The circumstances of this case where appellant came and as soon as that critical service period was over, discussed the foreclosure. You're right, the foreclosure proceeding could have restarted and then there would have been, you know, service being avoided or whatever over and over again, and it would just be a waste of everyone's time. Rather, the district court, you know, discussed.
Well, you could call it a waste of time or a compliance with the statute.
Your Honor, the statute was attempted to be complied with, and the district court pointed.
I guess that's what I'm getting at. Why is that enough? Attempts to comply with the statute if the statute wasn't complied with?
Because of the, Your Honor, because of the circumstances in this case where, you know, there was strong question that appellant knew of the foreclosure and knew that it was going to be postponed.
So what would be the case law or authority that would support the premise that you're relying upon and perhaps the district court relied upon, which is that if the party knows about it, we're going to disregard the service requirement in the statute, or assume that service has actually occurred when there's no evidentiary support that service occurred?
Your Honor, that's laid out in the substantial compliance framework that BALIC takes into account. This infraction here was so minor that it wouldn't make sense necessarily to restart this process, especially because the foreclosure was going to be postponed, which appellant was aware of, and because, you know, the foreclosure proceeding was moving along with both parties and kind of the same knowledge that it was moving along. Appellant still had his opportunity to redeem. He still had opportunities to challenge it, but he did. And with respect to the postponement, there were some similar issues there. But as the district court pointed out, I mean, what more notice could have appellant have gotten? I mean, other than physically being served, you know, he came out right after this critical service period and started discussing about the foreclosure.
Well, aren't there options under the statute if personal service is not affected, how a service can occur?
Well, taking appellant's argument of strict compliance, if it needed to be personally served, then there might not have been other options. Certainly notes were left at his door. It seems like appellant was well aware of the service attempts and that something was happening with his home. And service, there was publication of the foreclosure, which, you know, is kind of that second aspect of that statute that kind of helps guarantee the appellant's rights, which were guaranteed here to that effect. So, you know, the departure from the statute is, as the district court pointed out, it's just such a small infraction that it wouldn't make sense to restart this process and have these same issues, especially after.
And what would be the legal support for the wouldn't make sense argument?
Well, Your Honor, this foreclosure by statute or by advertisement is supposed to be an extrajudicial process, effectually avoiding service, even though that's not explicitly said in the record. It's bringing the judiciary in here, you know, taking up judicial economy. They could have restarted, but they chose to go the other way of respondent chose to postpone the statute, the foreclosure. And that postponement, you know, appellant argues had issues of its own. But
talk about that. So the statute says that there can be a postponement made, but it has to occur before the time of the thing being postponed. In this case, if I'm not mistaken, it was a postponement after the date of the sale that was in the initial notice. Am I correct about that?
Yes, Your Honor. The original sale was June 22nd. The postponed sale was sometime in November, but the publication wasn't served until September, which was well in advance of the statutory period that's prescribed in 580.07.
Right, but address the argument that you can't postpone, that the argument is, well, once that time lapsed and there was no postponement, once the date of sale lapsed and there was no notice of any postponement, that you've got to go back to square one now and begin the foreclosure proceeding anew, that the foreclosure action, I think that the argument is that it's lapsed. And so anything that happens later is just void. It's not part of that action. What is your client's counter argument to that?
Your Honor, the appellant had notice of the sale not going through. He knew that it wasn't going to go through, that there was going to be a sale at a later date.
I mean, a legal question. What's your argument as to the legal argument that's being made is, once there hasn't been a postponement by the foreclosing party, notice of postponement until after the thing that is being postponed has already occurred, that the foreclosure action is lapsed now. What's your position as to the merit to that argument?
Your Honor, respondent's position is only that appellant had notice of the postponement beforehand, whether the strict compliance of 580.07 was followed with before June 22nd is partially immaterial here, because again, the safeguard, the guardrails of 580.07 were met, namely that appellant had a fair opportunity to redeem or to, I'm sorry, not redeem, but had notice of this postponement and take some action. The district court, you know, opined and stated that, you know, they could have, respondent could have restarted the foreclosure proceeding, but it would just delay things further. It would give further benefit to appellant. So, you know, the conversations that took place between—
Why would that be the court's concern?
Your Honor, I'm can't speak to the district court's concern.
No, as a matter of the district court serving as neutral, why would the district court be concerned that one party not following the service requirements is, we're going to disregard the requirements because it would just prolong things and cause the party that failed to serve some inconvenience? Why is that the district court's concern?
Well, Your Honor, the statute was substantially complied with. It's a question of law whether the strict compliance is necessary here.
Well, what is the strict compliance versus substantial compliance authority? What's the best case that says that substantial compliance with service requirements of foreclosure are sufficient, besides the unpublished decision that we've been discussing?
I see my time is up. May I take a moment to finish
your
question? Your Honors, while Balik is non-precedential on this court, appellant's reliance on Hunter, appellant says Balik was abrogated by a case called Gunderson. Gunderson is a published opinion, and in that case, they do discuss, parts of Chapter 580 that can be substantially complied with. And because this is such a unique issue with a unique set of facts that wouldn't lead to an absurd result, respondent argues that substantial compliance is imparted on 580.07.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Christensen, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. A respondent used the telling metaphors of a critical service period, the guardrails that MnStat 580 sets up, and indeed the extrajudicial process that is a foreclosure by advertisement. Those metaphors are telling, because what the foreclosure after the failure to serve and the postponement that wasn't done notice before the original sale date, what that amounts to is surprise. And indeed, the conversations that Mr. Whalen had with the board after the foreclosure didn't occur was, you guys have issues and I have issues. And their response was, yes, we're going to foreclose by action. That would have brought the case before the court, and 580, the substantial compliance under 580 is not applied in a foreclosure by action. But that's not what happened. So whatever, if the court wants to examine what he knew or didn't know, which isn't, as Judge Ross's inquiry demonstrate, isn't the standard, but if you wanted to, what they knew after the sale was that they were going to take it to a different forum. And then that's not what happened. Indeed, it was 3 months later, 3 months after the fact. So the respondents, through application of 580.07, begs the question, how long in the future could they go? And I know this court doesn't like the parade of horribles argument, so I'm not going to do that. But is 3 months practicable? And I would leave it to you in chambers to answer yourself, extend that time and ask yourself the same question. And I think you'll find for every time you ask that question, the answer to yourself is no. Judge Ross, answering your question again, we can avoid the annulment issue altogether by looking at the first summary judgment motion. There the court said the association did not follow the law, but it doesn't matter. And that begs the question again, why annulment shouldn't be a waiver of claims, because there Whalen had brought the claims and brought a motion during the redemption period that should have resolved this question. He shouldn't be punished after the fact because he brought claims and was clearly not only prosecuting his claims during the litigation, but he expressed his intent to do that all along.
But counsel, I want to follow up on that waiver issue, because he had the opportunity to follow the procedure in Minnesota Statute 580.28. And both the Bailick case, which is non-precedential that respondents rely on, but also the collaborative case that you rely on, which is non-precedential, both point to that procedure. And that procedure would have allowed a mortgagee to preserve the right to redemption while still challenging the foreclosure by the advertisement itself as being void. But that didn't occur here, correct?
Well, it did occur. And it can be distinguished as well.
Under 580.28?
No, under private agreement. The parties had agreed that if the foreclosure was going to be set aside, that they would unwind the redemption. And here we have a third party that was involved, a junior creditor that redeemed. So the question that Whalen faced was, should he mitigate his damages with the third party creditor who redeemed? And he chose to by paying, so the third party creditor would be paid, and therefore getting them ostensibly out of the case.
But just to be clear,
yeah,
he did not follow 580.2.
He did not pay a bond, correct.
Well, there's several steps that need to be followed.
Sure.
Paying the bond, notifying the sheriff's office, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But it seems like those cases point to the fact that that is the process that could have and probably should have been followed in those situations, which are strikingly similar to the situation that we have here.
Well, in collaborative design, they hadn't brought a claim until they were faced with the Hobson's choice of what to do upon the occurrence of the redemption period. And they were also a junior creditor. They weren't a homeowner. So the question there is, what did they need to do to preserve their claims? And there's different rules for junior creditors. For instance, there's also case law that says that junior creditors accept redemption funds and they don't, and they accept a tender and they don't bring claims related to those, they waive claims related to the impropriety of the redemption. There's no case that says that for a homeowner besides sort of Bailick impliedly. And so I would disagree respectfully that it's not a waiver issue, because a waiver would require, I'm sorry, my time has run out. May I answer?
Yes, you may finish your answer.
Waiver is a known relinquishment of a right. And how could a Whalen knowingly relinquished a right to challenge the foreclosure when he was already doing it? He had brought a previous summary judgment motion where the law of the case is that they didn't follow the procedure. And then we brought those issues up again to remind the judge that it applied the wrong standard in the second summary judgment motion. The court ruled on that motion. And then by letter, the issue of the implications of annulment came in and there was a second hearing. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Thanks you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.